Good morning. The court recognizes the member of the court's bar, John Holt, for a motion.
It please the court. Good morning, Chief Judge, judges of the court. I move the admission of Carlina D. Schwing of the District of Columbia Court of Appeals. I've examined her credentials on file in the office of the clerk, and I'm satisfied that she possesses the qualifications for membership in the bar of this court. It's always a real pleasure to move the admission of any candidate for the bar, but as you know, Carlina has the privilege to serve in the chambers of Senior Judge Gerke, and so today is a privilege to move her.
Thank you. Your motion is granted, and the deputy clerk will administer the oath. Carlina, you join the more than 33,000 attorneys who have been admitted to our bar with a special opportunity to serve the men and women who serve our nation in uniform. Senior Judge Gerke often spoke of the many contributions that you made while serving in his chambers, and we're delighted to welcome you back to the court and to our bar. Thank you for being here today. You may be seated, and we will now proceed with United States against Reed, counsel for the defense.
Hey, please the court. My name is Captain Patrick Grant. Together with Colonel O'Brien, we represent the appellant, Master Sergeant Anthony Reed. The chain of command did not intentionally set out to coerce or manipulate Master Sergeant Reed's court-martial. The convening authority did, however, taint two of the five panel members who actually sat on the panel. In addition to the actual unlawful command influence, the command created apparent unlawful command influence by fostering a climate of zero tolerance for BH fraud that placed an intolerable strain upon the public's perception of the military justice system. This command climate is evidenced by the convening authority's email in which she stated she's absolutely uncompromising about BH fraud, by Lieutenant Colonel Carpenter's newcomers briefing in which she stated BH fraud is an automatic court-martial referral, and by the convening authority forecasting her views about BH fraud to appellant's raters. Turning to the panel members first, the military judge erroneously concluded that the panel members were not tainted directly or indirectly by unlawful command influence, and that the convening authority's email did not cause some unfairness in appellant's court-martial. The convening authority sent an email in which she stated, which she attached a slide that she stated she's absolutely uncompromising about discipline in the leader ranks, and she listed BH fraud as the first thing about which she's uncompromising about. Two of the panel members who actually sat on the appellant's court-martial received this email, Lieutenant Colonel Klimowitz and Command Sergeant Major Lopez. Although neither of these panel members remember reading the exact slide, the email did impact these members. Lieutenant Colonel Klimowitz stated that the message he received was that the convening authority is amazed that BH fraud continues. Command Sergeant Major Lopez stated the message he received is that the convening authority is trying to alleviate BH fraud. Appellant has therefore raised some evidence of unlawful command influence because the impact it had on the members impairs appellant's right to have a fair and impartial panel.
What evidence do you have of that point, that specific point?
Well, Your Honor, it also causes unfairness in this court-martial, too, because now you have two panel members who, even though they said they don't believe that there's a specific policy regarding BH fraud, they do know that the convening authority is amazed that it continues, and she wants to alleviate BH fraud, and they are taking this understanding of the convening authority's elevated concern for BH fraud into the deliberation room with them.
And that's your evidence of prejudice, or how his trial is unfair because of those emails?
Yes, Your Honor. It's not the emails itself. It's the impact that the emails had upon the members.
And the impact the evidence that you have of impact is what you just described for us?
Yes, Your Honor. It's what the panel members, what Colonel Klimowitz and Command Sergeant Major Lopez said.
Is there anything else? Anything else at all that you have?
Through the email? No, Your Honor.
Did they indicate that they received the second email?
They said neither one of them received the second email, Your Honor.
In your view, had they, could the second email have corrected the problem?
It could have, Your Honor. A better way to correct this problem is the party should have followed this court's direction in U.S. v. Thomas, where it said basically you have to determine whether or not the panel members heard the intemperate remarks from the convening authority, and if so, would it impact their ability to render a fair and impartial judgment? And here, there was simply no attempt to rehabilitate these members after they both stated, well, after they stated that their amazement continues and she wants to alleviate BH fraud. They never asked them whether or not this elevated concern of the convening authority would affect their ability to render an impartial.
Now, do we know they didn't get the email, or is the record not clear as to whether they got the corrective email?
During the voir dire, they state that they did not receive the second email, Your Honor.
Counsel, I just want to clarify your argument. Are you arguing that, well, let me reword that. Are you conceding that there is not actual UCI on any of these three incidents, but that together taken they create a climate that creates apparent UCI?
No, Your Honor.
Okay.
My argument is that there is actual UCI, and that when she emails these panel members, it impacts them, and this causes unfairness in appellant's court-martial.
So,
I also...
Okay. Well, go ahead.
I also argue apparent unlawful command influence, because the command does create a climate of zero tolerance for BH fraud that places an intolerable strain upon...
Are you arguing actual UCI in all three incidents, or
just... No,
something?
No, just
the
just
email.
Just the email and the way it affected these two panel members. Sure.
And getting back to Judge Ryan's question, what evidence is there in the record that actually shows that there was an influence?
It's the impact that the email has, Your Honor. You have Colonel Climowitz saying that the convening authority is amazed that BH fraud continues, and Command Sergeant Major Lopez saying she wants to alleviate it. And they're taking this elevated understanding or elevated concern that the convening authority has for BH fraud into the deliberation room with them. So when they're considering a sentence or whether they're finding guilty, they have this in the back of their mind, and there's simply no attempt to rehabilitate these members.
I mean, I guess my question is, what evidence do you have that was in the back of their mind? Didn't they testify to the contrary? I mean, didn't the military judge allow individual voir dire of these particular members with respect to this specific email, and didn't he make a finding of fact that he was satisfied that they were going to be able to properly discharge the duties and not take into consideration the email?
Well, Your Honor, first of all, no one ever asked them if they could disregard the email. So the military judge is certainly making a leap of faith there. Also, if you look at the way... if you look for the challenge for cause for Lieutenant Colonel Climowitz, the military judge didn't even consider apparent unlawful command influence. The defense challenged on implied bias, and in addressing the challenge for cause, the military judge stated that there is no doubt in my mind that Colonel Climowitz can render a fair judgment. But as this court well knows, the test for apparent unlawful command influence is an objective test. It has to be through an objective, disinterested observer who's fully aware of all the facts and circumstances.
Well, now, wait a minute. Are you arguing actual or apparent now?
I'm arguing actual for the two panel members.
Okay, and what's standard for that?
It has to show a logical connection to... the standard is it has to be the defense must raise some evidence of unlawful.
Right, more than mere speculation, as I recall, is the quote.
Yes,
how is this more than mere speculation? All you know is there was an email and they got it.
Well, you know more than that. You know that Colonel Climowitz knows that his boss, the convening authority, is amazed that BH fraud continues. And that Command Sergeant Major Lopez...
Well, but is it more than mere speculation to tie up the outcome of this trial?
I'm sorry, what's that?
Well, it seems to me that so far you haven't tied this to the outcome.
Well, Your Honor, it's tied to the outcome because two of the five panel members, Colonel Climowitz is the president of the panel,
mm-hmm.
and they're taking this elevated knowledge of the convening authority's concern for BH fraud into the deliberation room with them. And it impairs the punch right to have a fair and impartial panel.
Can I return to Judge Erdman's question, the confusion over what you're arguing? In your brief, in your summary of argument, you say the command did not actually manipulate appellant's trial, and then the next section goes on about talking about the creating the appearance of command influence. Is it the problem, I guess, arises from the sentence, the command did not actually manipulate appellant's trial? And so you're, as I understand it, you're arguing there is actual UCI with respect to the two members?
Yes, Your Honor.
Whether or not the command actually manipulated the trial?
No, what I'm saying is the command didn't intend to manipulate the trial.
I see. So the problem is with the use of the word actual. I'm not trying to, you missed the comma over here, but the point is to fully appreciate your argument, not to give you a hard time, but so you're saying no specific and no intent to do it, but in fact they actually did.
Yes, Your Honor. Just in regards to the two panel members.
Well, help me with this.
Yes, Your Honor.
It appears to me, and not that this is improper, but that you are making a different argument in oral argument today than you made in your brief. On page 15 of your brief, you describe the Klimowitz and the Lopez testimony or statements during the voir dire. And then, and Garrett as well. Then, you say at the bottom of the page, apparent unlawful command influence therefore allowed at least two panel members to bring their understanding to the convening authority. So, unless I missed something, you did not make an actual command influence argument in your brief, but you're now making it today. Is that correct,
Your Honor?
Okay. So, going back then to the statements on page 15 of your brief made by Klimowitz and the others, and if there had been no email in this case, what is remarkable about a commander saying that she is amazed to see BH fraud continuing, that she does so in a way that leaves the listener knowing that there's no predisposition to those cases, and a commander saying that BAH fraud is an important issue and it's unsatisfactory to senior leaders to do something wrong. Wouldn't it be remarkable if a commander didn't say those things?
Well, Your Honor, she says more than that, though. She says she's absolutely uncompromising.
Now, I'm talking just about what you've quoted on page 15 for the actual command influence. The uncompromising is in the email that they don't remember. So I'm just focusing now on the statements that they remember and your suggestion that they were both actually influenced by unlawful command influence. And my question is, what is remarkable about those statements that you quote on page 15? Why aren't those statements that we would anticipate that any commander would make in discussing BAH fraud?
It is the impact of the message on the members that I argue. It's this, the panel members know that the convening authority has this elevated concern for BAH fraud. They know that she's concerned with it. She wants to alleviate it. She's amazed that it's continued.
So your view is a commander, by virtue of the case law and the statute dealing with unlawful command influence, disabled from ever addressing the existence of criminal activity within the command?
No, Your Honor. And in fact, Patricia Hamm, who this court cited in Simpson, I believe, give some examples where commanders can address these issues with avoiding negative impact or the impact of UCI. And some of the principles she gives is, talk offense, not offender. Avoid the remarks on an expected outcome.
Well, isn't she talking offense, not offender? Did she mention or did she just mention an elevated concern about the offense of the AH fraud?
Well, the impact of the message seems to imply that there's an expected result here because she wants it. The email itself, first of all, does talk offender, but the impact, the panel members didn't get that. So what I'm just saying here is what they did get is that it kind of implies that she wants a certain result here because she's amazed BAH fraud continues and she wants to alleviate it.
Well, then I ask again what the chief judge asked. What can a commander do when criminal activity is going on in the command, must he or she remain mum or trigger UCI?
No, they do have to be careful about their remarks, and such as using language is absolutely uncompromising. It implies what is left there that she expects. I can give you a quote for a better email if you like, Your Honor. In fact, she could have said something of, all soldiers, regardless of rank, are expected to follow the law. The facts of each case of BH4 will be individually assessed and thoroughly examined to determine the appropriate level of justice, regardless of rank of the offender.
Well, I mean, you mentioned the Simpson case. How is absolutely uncompromising a more stringent standard than zero tolerance?
Well, in Simpson, Your Honor, during the individual voir dire, you have the panel member stating that their view of zero tolerance means that just what I said, that they're not going to ignore incidents of sexual harassment regardless of rank, it's going to be investigated. And here you simply don't have that individual voir dire as you did in the Simpson case. All you're left with here is Colonel Kleinwood saying, you know, he knows the Marine Authority is amazed at his continuing, and Command Sergeant Major Lopez saying she wants to alleviate the age fraud. So that's Simpson. They essentially rehabilitated those members, Your Honor. Or is that didn't happen? You know?
So is that what your argument is? Is that the failure here is that the military judge didn't rehabilitate the members sufficiently?
Thompson certainly does require that. You're left with the answers the panel members gave, Your Honor.
So is that what you're fixing on as your basis for the actual unlawful command influence, which is that there was some evidence raised and that the military judge didn't properly rehabilitate them?
That is part of my argument, yes, Your Honor. The argument is you're left with the answers that the panel members gave.
Can you please go through the findings of fact and conclusions of law and indicate exactly what the judge got right and wrong, well, got wrong from your standpoint? And why?
Yes, Your Honor. Well, first of all, in regards just to the panel members, Your Honor.
Take your shot. Yeah, this is your opportunity.
Well, first of all,
you can limit it to one paragraph if you like, but you might want to try all your paragraphs.
Yes, Your Honor. The first one is paragraph 3-11, or 3-11. Where Major General Edmonds, did not tell Colonel Chan that she would, what she would do if he didn't change the comments. Colonel Chan stated that Major General Edmonds told him that she was going to not concur in the NCOR if he didn't change it. She never told him he had to change it, but she did tell him that she was going to non-concur. Paragraph 3.20. Again, which says that the commanding authority did not influence Colonel Chan to change his comments. It just doesn't make any sense. He wouldn't have changed his comments but for her calling him into her office, and saying, you misinterpreted the regulation. You can include these comments on the NCOR. The last sentence of paragraph 344, it says, Lieutenant Colonel Plumley said words to the effect of paragraph 345. The comments Lieutenant Colonel Plumley made on the 29th July 2003 about BH-12 reflected Colonel Plumley's opinion and not the opinion of any other person. At the newcomers' briefing, Colonel Plumley introduced himself on behalf of the 20th Area Support Group Commander, Colonel Joyner. He then welcomed the audience to Korea on behalf of that commander, and then he went on to say that BH fraud is going to be an automatic court-martial referral. Even though those comments, they were Colonel Plumley's view on BH fraud, it's the way he presented them to the crowd after introducing himself on behalf of the Special Court-Martial Commanding Authority that the crowd would not be able to interpret those solely as Colonel Plumley's comments.
I'm getting the full menu before.
I'm sorry.
I'm trying to let you do your full menu before we interrupt you.
Okay.
So make sure you get through your full menu.
Yes, Sean.
Unless you're at the end.
No, I'm not. Paragraph 3-48, it says that none of the court members were actually present at the newcomers' briefing. They only asked Colonel Kleinwoods and Command Sergeant Major Lopez if they attended. None of the other members were asked if they attended the newcomers' briefing. Paragraph 354, military judge says that that is a finding of fact. However, it's appellant's position that that is a conclusion of law, where he states that the court members that sat on Master Sergeant Reed's case were not tainted directly or indirectly by unlawful command influence. And I address that in my argument. As for the conclusions of law, the defense says that those are all incorrect.
Counsel, could you address what's in effect your saturation argument? That is, that at some point, irrespective of what the members say in voir dire, that there's so much command influence in the case, so saturated that it amounts to apparent unlawful command influence. And what's your saturation argument here, and what case from our court would you draw your closest analogy to?
First, Your Honor, the saturation comes in, you have to look at what Sergeant Butler, Captain Murray, Command Sergeant Mayor Carter, what they all testified to, because they're well aware of this command climate of zero tolerance for BAH fraud. Sergeant Butler, a member of the 19th Theater Support Command, says that soldiers throughout that command know that if you commit BAH fraud, you are far worse off than soldiers who commit a more egregious crime. He flippantly states that you can commit murder and be better off than committing BAH fraud. You have Captain Murray, who is a potential panel member that the government successfully challenged for cause. And he noticed the crackdown in the past year and a half on BAH fraud. And he was biased towards the defense because he sees people being charged with BAH fraud now receiving harsher punishments than what they had in the past. And therefore, he would be biased towards the defense and giving a lighter punishment. You have Command Sergeant Major Carter talking with Sergeant Butler about the NCAR incident. And their impression was is that the convening authority called Colonel Chan into her office and ripped into him to make him change the NCAR. It's when you have an objective, disinterested observer, such as Captain Murray, Sergeant Butler, Command Sergeant Major Carter, who are aware of this command climate of zero tolerance for BAH fraud, it simply places, they're going to harbor significant doubts about the fairness of Master Sergeant Murray's court-martial. Especially when they watch the military judge seat two panel members who are taking the elevated concern of the convening authority into the deliberation room with them.
And what case would you cite as being the closest analogy to what we have before us?
I haven't really found a saturation case, maybe Stoneman, where the convening, where the brigade commander sends out an email saying he will crush leaders who commit DUI, and he listed other offenses to that amount. That would be the closest action. But again, I haven't found such a saturation case like ours.
Thank you.
Well, if there are no further questions, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for the government.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Captain Nicole Fish, and I, along with Colonel John Miller, represent the United States in this matter. In this case, the military judge did not err in his findings of fact or conclusions of law regarding unlawful command influence. The standard of review for findings of fact is clearly erroneous, and the standard of review as to whether facts constitute UCI is de novo. Today, I'm going to discuss three distinct situations which did not affect appellant's court-martial. First, the newcomer's brief. Second, the non-commissioned officer's evaluation report, both of which appellant concedes in his brief that he did not meet his initial burden in the email. First, in reference to Colonel Clooney's brief, the military judge properly concluded the appellant did not satisfy his initial burden, that there was no UCI, and the brief did not taint the judicial process. This case was already going to trial based on its own individual merits and circumstances as determined by General Edmonds, approved the Article 32 investigation and referral on June 24th. There was no member that was influenced by this briefing. The court martial, two were asked on individual voir dire if they attended this brief, and none attended the brief. There was no logical connection to the appellant's court martial in terms of potential unfairness, let alone did that affect the findings and sentence. Second, the NCOER. The military judge properly concluded that the appellant did not satisfy his burden, that there was no UCR, and that the NCOER did not influence the court proceedings. There was no UCI because General Edmonds properly conducted herself in accordance with Army regulations. She did not engage in the UCI by forecasting her non-concurrence with appellant's evaluation and her role as reviewer. She provided lawful command guidance in accordance with Army Regulation 623-205. She had read the CID report and the Article 32 investigation, spoke with the SJA, and determined that derogatory information could be included. She was then required to discuss with the reviewer the basis for the discrepancy. But for her actions, General Edmonds would have been delinquent in her duties. The evidence indicates that there is no logical connection to this court-martial in terms of potential unfairness. She was simply following regulations in her administrative capacity as reviewer. Third, the email and PowerPoint presentation. The military judge properly concluded that the appellant failed to satisfy his burden. There was no UCI, and that the government has shown beyond a reasonable doubt that the claimed UCI did not taint the judicial process. There is no logical connection to this court-martial in terms of potential unfairness. This is simply a case of a commander's lawful command influence to promote good order and discipline, to emphasize that rank does not give you privilege, but if you commit a crime, there are consequences.
Why did the Lieutenant Colonel Anderson advise the general then to clarify the email if there's nothing wrong with it? Lieutenant colonels generally tell generals to do things gratuitously.
The SJA spoke with General Edmonds in case that there was any confusion and recommended that she send out a clarification email that in case anyone did misconstrue the absolutely uncompromising about discipline comment.
So that raises the prospect that anybody who saw this email may have misconstrued it.
Potential. Yes, Your Honor.
With sufficient possibility that a lieutenant colonel told a general to fix her email or do something, which is an awkward thing to do, both for the general and for the lieutenant colonel. And what is your response to the appellant's argument that two of those members received the first email but not the second email?
With respect to Colonel Klingowitz, he actually he received the email, but he did not receive the slide presentation which was attached, which had those words that were at issue of absolutely uncompromising about discipline.
So your first argument is it's 1 out of 5.
For?
Who received the offending language.
Correct.
And what's your response then to the one who didn't receive it?
Sergeant Major Lopez, which is the other individual who received the email, basically did not have any particular view on BAH, went through a long explanation on the withholding policy more than any other effect that the focus was not on BAH, but on standards. Now, in reference to that email.
So your response on that is that in your reading of Sergeant Major Lopez's statements, what he drew from the slide presentation was not a focus on the BHS and uncompromising and so on.
Correct. It was that there are standards in the military that we must abide by. And if you don't abide by standards, that it's unsat. Also in reference to the email, she in no way directed a specific course of action by any commander. She did not mention the appellant's name. She did not influence any court-martial to act in any manner. She, in fact, provided lawful guidance. Because the prohibition against UCI does not mean that a commander may abdicate responsibility for correcting disciplinary problems, and those were the six things that she did list on that slide. Now, it is true that those two panel members did receive it, but three other potential panel members did not receive the email at all.
Now, what do you say to the defense's milieu argument?
you know, that there was a pervasive climate, you know, apart from any particular actual UCI with respect to any particular court member, but that the totality of the actions created a milieu in which the thing was so pervaded with the appearance of UCI that this accused couldn't get a fair trial.
This accused got a fair trial in the sense that the findings and sentence were not affected.
Are you saying there was no such milieu, or if there was, it didn't affect the trial?
Right, and also U.S. v. Simpson provides some factors that help show that.
Well, which one?
You said right to a compound question.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Was there no such atmosphere, or assuming there was, it did not affect the trial? Which one?
For the first one. There was no such atmosphere to the UCI. Just a commander with lawful command guidance trying to put out that there's issues out here that we have to address, things that are illegal, and they need to be addressed, and make sure that we don't ignore, you know, BAH, curfew, drugs, sexual misconducts, all the things that are relevant in Korea more so necessarily than in other locations.
One of the underlying themes of our unlawful command influence jurisprudence is that members of the armed forces will perceive command interests in a manner that may go beyond what the commander's immediate intent is, but instead seek to implement the full spirit of the words. And so if we had testimony in this case, or voir dire responses, that the phrase absolutely uncompromising would mean in the minds of those who listened that every case would be referred to a GCM with the expectation of maximum punishment, would we be in a different situation than we are now?
I think that she did not, in this circumstance, she had said the absolutely uncompromising discipline didn't necessarily say any specific course of conduct.
I understand your argument as to what she said, and let's assume that that was her intent. That's not my question. My question is, in the military environment, if it is perceived by those who hear it that absolutely uncompromising means you don't compromise. If you have a court martial, if you have an offense, it goes to a court martial. If it goes to a court martial, it goes to a GCM. If it goes to a GCM, there's an expectation that someone will get the maximum. No compromise. Now, if the record were to show that, or in the defense view, if the record reasonably can be viewed as interpreted that way, then do we have the same situation or a different situation? I understand your argument that the record should not be read that way, but if that's what we had before us, would it nonetheless be no problem if as long as those words can be read in different ways, doesn't matter what effect it has on the listeners?
I think that, like in U.S. v. Simpson, where they said the implication of the zero tolerance, it depends on the training and experience of the person hearing. So if they did perceive that, and that is the way it came across, and the evidence was in the record to support it, then at that point, you would be more towards defense side on what they're arguing.
Right. So the issue isn't necessarily what the commander intended. It's what impact it had on those who then go into trial to deliberate in the case.
Correct, Your Honor. And that's where the voir dire and the extensive voir dire questioning came into play with those panel members.
You're not arguing otherwise, though, are you?
No, Your Honor.
With respect to paragraph 54, the findings and conclusions of law, the court members that sat on MSG Reed's case were not tainted directly or indirectly by UCI. Is that a finding of fact or conclusion of law? Do you know what I'm talking about?
I believe that is a finding of fact based on the information that was with, like,
Isn't that the ultimate conclusion as to whether there was UCI or not? And that's a statement as to whether or not there was UCI, right?
Correct, Your Honor.
I mean, you're lying. It's a rhetorical question. I mean, what's your answer? Is that something we review sort of de novo, or is this something we're supposed to apply a clearly erroneous standard to?
I believe that it would be the facts that are prior support that it is a conclusion.
Okay. Thank you. I appreciate your directness.
Now, in reference to the email and the panel members, each of the members confirmed during extensive voir dire that they could be fair and impartial, that they could take this case based on its individual merits. And the military judge observed these members' demeanor and made his judgment that they were sincere and could in fact be fair and impartial and make a determination based on this appellant's case and the facts presented. Now, the email was simply a commander establishing their leadership climate, developing a disciplined and cohesive unit, as they are chartered to do, not UCI. Now, even if this court was to find that there was some form of UCI, it must also conclude that the findings and sentence were not affected. That the brief NCOR and the email did not taint this court-martial, that the military judge found that the court members that sat on the appellant's case were not tainted directly or indirectly by UCI. The military judge was able to observe the demeanor of the panel members during his extensive voir dire, where he properly clarified and questioned members to ensure their impartiality. There also was factors such as the transfer of responsibility for final disposition of the charges in this case, the use of discovery for pretrial hearings to delineate the scope and impact of the alleged UCI. General Edmonds also personally requested that Captain Nelson, the trial defense counsel, remain appellant's counsel when he had PCS'd. The appellant's guilt was overwhelming. The documentary evidence, the finance document for divorce decree, the custody agreement, all clearly established that he was divorced without custody and still claiming money. He was already paying back over $20,000 from a previous duty assignment where he was living on post and collecting BAH. The sentence here was fair and reasonable. The maximum punishment allowable was 35 years, reduction to E1, a dishonorable discharge, forfeitures of pay allowances, and a fine. Yet he received reduction to E1, confinement for 1 year, and a bad conduct discharge. In addition, the panel actually made a recommendation for clemency to provide for child support for the maximum allowable while he was in confinement. Thus, the evidence supports that the government has shown beyond a reasonable doubt that the UCI did not affect the findings and sentence. There are no further questions. May I briefly conclude?
Please.
There has been no intolerable strain on the public perception of the military justice system. The military judge properly concluded that there was no UCI, and even if there was, that the government has proven beyond a reasonable doubt that the findings and sentence were not affected.
Thank you, counsel. Does the defense have a rebuttal?
Yes, sir.
The governor stated that there was extensive voir dire where the military judge was able to determine that each member was fair and impartial and could decide the case on the facts. That just didn't happen. You're not going to see that in this record of trial. There was extensive general voir dire where the military judge asked those basic questions, can you decide this case fairly? And even Captain Murray responded yes to that, and the government on page 408 and 414, Captain Murray said yes, there's nothing in this case that will impair my ability to render a judgment or decide a sentence. And yet the government successfully challenged him for cause after individual voir dire where he admitted that he was biased towards the defense. So the questions asked during general voir dire certainly didn't cure the issues that were raised during individual voir dire.
Was there any question that the defense wanted to have asked that was not asked?
I'm sorry.
Was there any question that the defense wanted to have asked that was not asked? What does the record show us on that?
I think that The defense is the one who ended up asking, do you know of any specific policy regarding VAH fraud? But again, neither of the parties ever got to the fact of, is this going to impair their ability to render a fair judgment?
Okay, thank you.
Also, the government argued that transferring the case to a new convening authority tended to ameliorate any unlawful command influence. That's simply not the case, because here we're talking about the taint of the panel members and apparent unlawful command influence to Apple's trial. For example, in U.S. v. Harvey, where the convening authority he was replaced by a new commander that came in, and so he's no longer the convening authority. He walks into the courtroom during closing argument. The defense counsel perceives, doesn't know he's there, but he perceives the panel members looking over his shoulder, and he comes in a flight suit, and apparently he has a relationship with one of the panel members, but he's no longer the convening authority. So there the court still found unlawful command influence. So the fact that they simply replaced a convening authority to handle post-trial matters doesn't cure the taint on the two panel members.
What's your response to the government's response to your two-fifths, one-fifth argument? The response was that at least one of the two that you were identifying, the colonel, in fact, did not receive the slide attachments.
Yes, Your Honor. As this court said in U.S. v. Thomas, it's not necessarily the remarks themselves that you have to look at. It is the impact of the remarks. For example, in Thomas, the commander said, you know,
how can the remarks have impact if you don't see them?
Because he did say he received an email. He said he wasn't sure if he received the slide or doesn't remember receiving the slide, but he said the message he received was that the convening authority is amazed that the VAH fraud continued. So whether or not he received the slide, he certainly received the impact of that message, Your Honor. And this court recognizes that in Thomas, you have to look at the impact of the message. For in Thomas, the commander said, you know, it's a paradox for
you. Here you mean message as in the climate rather than the email message.
In discussing it, Colonel Kleinwood states that he received an email. He doesn't remember slide attachments or reading slide attachments, but somehow, without reading a slide attachment or remembering a slide attachment, he certainly knows that the message of the email was that she was amazed that the age fraud continues. And those are Colonel Kleinwood's words. In conclusion, the military judge erroneously concluded that unlawful command influence did not cause unfairness in the appellant's court-martial because the convening authority actually tainted two of the panel members who sat on the court-martial. In addition to the actual command influence, the command created a climate of zero tolerance for BAH fraud by placing intolerable strain on the public's perception of the fairness of the military justice system. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. And we thank counsel for both parties for your presentation today. The case is now submitted, and the court will stand at recess until 9:45 a.m.
it's easy. I mean, if you would.
Okay, I'm the other person.
Wow.